Regardless of where you are in your homesteading journey, whether you are just starting out or you've been at it for a while, there is no way that any of us can know absolutely everything when it comes under the homesteading umbrella. And this is where it is key that you are learning from people who have life experience and have been doing this homesteading when it comes to livestock in the kitchen, but they have been doing it for a long time so that you can bypass the mistakes that they have made along the way. And getting it delivered in your mailbox, in your hands every single month from some of the most trusted voices in homesteading is exactly what you need. And Homestead Living now has Homesteading Monthly, which is an in-print monthly magazine featuring articles from Joel Salatin, myself, Carolyn Thomas, as well as homesteaders who you may not have heard from them, but they have been perfecting their craft and are very much an expert in their area. You can get this for less than $2 an issue. Yes, that is an in-print, jam-packed with articles every single month. Go to homesteadliving.com and grab your subscription right now.
Welcome to episode number 260. Today's episode is really a fun one. We are diving into permaculture, which permaculture kind of has a, I hate to use the word trendy, but it has a lot of interest and has kind of made this huge leap, and there's more awareness of using permaculture methods. And the cool thing about permaculture is it's best known for maximizing production in large agriculture lands, but the rules are working with nature, right? And so nature is universal, regardless if you're using it upon acres and acres of growing crops or in a small backyard or small backyard garden or small space. The rules and laws of nature, they don't really change. So you can use permaculture principles that can help you grow your own food, even, and maybe even, not just even, but especially if you've got a small, tiny backyard or garden plot. Today's episode, I have guests on, which is really fun. And I think this is the first time that I have ever had a guest actually sing. You're going to love it though. It's not what you think. It's a way to help you remember some of these principles as you go about applying permaculture to your garden and your yard. But I'm super excited to introduce you to Nikki and Dave from Permaculture Gardens. Nikki and Dave are passionate about helping families grow their own food. They run permaculture gardens at growmyownfood.com. And what's really cool is they, even with strict homeowners association, where they can't really have a what we would think of as a typical vegetable garden in their front yard and their backyard, which is really small and has a lot of shade, but they have been able to use these permaculture principles to grow in shady spots and in a small backyard, but to pack a ton of food. And you'll hear it in the episode. They've actually documented how many pounds of food they get out of this small space. So it's really incredible. And not only is that part incredible, but the way that they break it down and share it so that you and I can use these same principles and applying to our spaces to grow more food. So without further ado, let's dive straight into this interview. There's a lot of fun stuff and value-packed information in it. And to get to any of the resources that we mention, links and everything like that, you can go to melissaknorris.com/260, which is the number 260, because this is episode number 260, because I'm sure you're going to want to dive into a lot of the information that we're sharing in today's episode.
So guys, I'm really excited to talk to today's guest because they have really mastered growing a food garden in a relatively small amount of space. So Nikki and Dave, welcome to the Pioneering Today podcast.
Thanks so much Melissa. For having us, Melissa.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you guys because as we move further into the landscape of COVID-19 and restrictions, travel, and even just food supplies, we have a lot of grocery stores that are running out or having a hard time stocking things. I really feel that we're going to see more and more people turning back to gardening and growing some of their own food. It may be something that they had wanted to do. It kind of been on the plans, like someday I'm going to get to this, or man, I want to do this later on, but now this is there later. Like it came sooner, I think, than a lot of people anticipated. But I know I have a lot of listeners and a lot of people have the need to grow their own food this year, but they don't maybe have a really large, they don't have acreage, or they don't even have a really large backyard or a huge lot. And so a lot of times people feel, well, I just don't have the space to really grow very much. And so I'm really excited to talk to you guys because you live in a very urban environment and you use the concept of permaculture and a food forest in an urban environment, which I feel is not as commonly done. So can you tell people a little bit about your growing space and then how you guys do some of your different plots?
Well, I'll start off and then Dave can chime in with more of the details, but we grow in 1/40th of an acre, which in a tiny townhouse flanked by other townhouses. So we're not an edge townhouse. And we definitely start, we grew 90 pounds of our produce a year, and that slowly crept up to now 300 plus pounds a year, which basically translates to 25% right now of our fruits and vegetables. And the way that we did this is something that Dave calls multipliers. So Dave can talk a little bit more about what your
multipliers are. Sure. So we're applying permaculture in our small yard to maximize the amount of, because we have a small space, we have to be really efficient. So there's things that you can do just to kind of easily multiply the harvest that you get out of there. So we're doing four season gardening. So we actually rotate three separate crops through the annual crops, the same space. We're also growing perennials in that same space. So we're doing a rich, diverse polyculture of both perennial and annual crops. In the front yard, we have a pretty strict HOA. So the first year I was doing experiments with pumpkins. It's probably not the greatest idea. And now we are a lot more concerned with the aesthetic. We still grow a lot of edibles in the front yard, but we have to keep the rampant foliage down. So we do most of our gardening in our backyard. What we've done is we put a fence around our backyard. So it's maybe a total of 20 square feet by 25 square feet. And we've made a keyhole beds in the center of that, and then L-shaped beds along the fence. And then, so we do four season gardening. That's one of the things that we think it's just an easy way for us to multiply the harvest that we get. We also have trellising. So what we use something called a cattle fence panel, kind of bent that over into a hoop, and we grow a lot of vertical crops. So you can grow things like melons and lots of pole beans and things like that vertically, and it takes up a lot less horizontal space.
Plus the sides are espaliered, which just means to train the trees, that we have some fruit trees in the backyard as well in a shoulder by shoulder fashion where things are lined up like an old English garden against, and they're fruiting hopefully that way as well as the blackberries. But sorry to interrupt you, Dave.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that in a small space you can utilize dwarf fruit trees. To in our backyard we have about 10 fruit trees. So as long as you're using dwarf fruit trees and keeping them pruned down to about 6 to 8 feet tall, And you can also espalier them. So that actually trains them along to use even less space. So you can actually get a lot in a small yard.
So you guys have, so I love that you said a 40th of an acre. And in my mind, I'm like, I don't even think I can comprehend a 40th of an acre. So that was when you said the 20 by 25 foot, that's primarily in your backyard. And that's the majority of the growing space that you have. And then when you were explaining your beds, I'm assuming that these are raised beds, or is it in-ground gardening, or is it a combination of both?
So they're raised beds. We originally used wood as a edging. We're now kind of in the process of converting that over to brick. But they're primarily raised beds, but there's in the center is kind of like a keyhole shaped bed, so it's not rectangular.
Mm-hmm, yeah, they're still raised.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I know people, I have to have the visual in my mind, like cemented when we're talking about it. And so thank you for that. I just wanted to make sure that I was envisioning it right as you guys were explaining and going through there. So I also love vertical gardening, even though I do have acreage. We use a lot of vertical gardening. Pole beans are one of my favorite. You're talking my love language there for just the exact same reasons that you guys listed, as well as in a humid and more wet climate like I live in. It helps to cut down on disease when I have things up vertically because of the airflow too. But one of the questions is, what is your guys's, I'm very curious about when we grow four seasons, because I try to grow year round as much as possible, even being pretty north. But what is your guys's climate like? Like, when is your average first frost in the fall? Or excuse me, yeah, your first frost in the fall and then your last frost in the spring and your gardening zone, and just kind of your overall climate there.
Yeah, we are USDA 7B, and first frost, last frost, Dave, you would know better than me.
So, yeah, we start to get light frost maybe in, I'd say, late October. And then we'll start to get heavy frost in the beginning of December. So it's temperate, but it does warm up pretty quickly in the spring. But then you can get, it's very temperamental, in the sense that you can get temperatures in the winter that get down to about 6 degrees Fahrenheit. But generally, temperatures in the winter will get down into the 20s or the teens. So we can grow some kind of subtropical trees here. We have some fig trees in the front yard. I have some feijoa bushes in the front yard that are able to survive.
We try to push the edges too. So because our summers are very humid and hot, we do a lot of the tropical, like ginger, turmeric. We try to do those kind of cash crops because they're expensive to buy. They're very healthy and we use them a lot for herbals. And then we can extend the edges. Like, I was just looking at the USDA temperatures, like today for when can we do potatoes? We're already, you know, doing potatoes out, and you know, it's late for fava beans for us right now and late for peas. But as the climate changes too, we have been finding there are more warm things that we can grow. And to the cold season, we do use hoops. So our raised beds, we curve an electrical conduit, which is $3 to buy from Home Depot. And so we bend that hoop, and then we put Agribon row covers around at the beginning of the fall season towards, you know, as it gets colder and colder, that's the first layer. And when the snow comes in, then we cover that with a second layer of more of plastic material, which we reuse every year. That helps us grow carrots through the winter. Our Jerusalem artichokes are ready in February, so we still harvest things throughout the year. Lettuces and radishes, we started them like in February under the hoops, and then now they're ready. So
The cool thing about the load tunnels is it doesn't provide a ton of protection, but it provides maybe like 10 to 15 degrees. So you can grow a lot of these things that can tolerate a light frost. They're somewhat hardy. And that's usually enough. Surprisingly enough, it's even if the temperatures get down into the low tens, they pretty much will stay alive. So there's a lot of things like lettuce that we can grow through the winter. That we wouldn't be, sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, love. And we're always trying to experiment as well with the varieties that work in our climate and suggest the ones that might work in our other clients' climates, because we do have people that we help around the US who have different climates, and then we think this didn't work so well for us, but in Washington, because you're colder, I think this might not molt if you use it. And so we do like trading those kind of secrets around.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I'm very much like you guys. I love to push the envelope and just see, well, will this really work or will it not? I feel like my garden is like one huge test and science experiment.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's really fun. And it's interesting because I'm 7A technically on the USDA map and you guys are 7B. But
yeah.
So it's so fascinating because those gardening zones are great for knowing, you know, your perennials, usually if they're going to survive the low temps in the winter. But as far as like planting dates and all of that, it's so vast and it's so different, which is something I don't know about you guys, but I find myself having to really share that a lot, especially to new gardeners, because they think, oh, well, like technically I'm zone 7, even though I'm 7A and you're zone 7B, but our planting dates and frost dates are going to be pretty different on a lot of things. And unfortunately, a lot of new gardeners jump in and are like, oh, I'm just going to plant everything according to, you know, zone 7. And it's like, ooh, that's not always the best idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm with you guys with the hoop houses and some are unheated high tunnels and et cetera during the winter months. I find that in the coldest part of the morning, I have an infrared thermometer that I go out and I measure soil temps. I'm such a geek.
No, that's wonderful.
And I find when it's like right before the sun starts to hit the coldest type, I will find about a consistent, I can count on at least a 5 degree warmer inside with a single layer, 5 degrees with a single layer of extra protection warmth. So I can, like you guys, I can grow lettuce all year round. I do find, because I don't supplement with any light, and I'm assuming that you guys don't either, that for the lettuce and stuff, as long as I have it already somewhat established, like by the first part of December, because we're a little bit warmer the first part of December usually than we are come January and February, that it'll grow really slowly. So if I've already got it established, then I can continue to harvest off of it. But I don't get a ton of growth until usually the end of February when we get more light and things start to warm up just a little bit. Do you notice that too?
Yeah, we definitely do. Like now is, and then when the light comes, then it's everything starts bolting. Then you have to be fast with the harvest, and then we find that now that's where our varieties really, really matter, because then we're like, what is the slow bolting lettuce that we can? Because for here, at least in our experience, the lettuce starts bolting as soon as it gets, like right now, they're starting to turn bitter. But in the back, in our backyard, in the front yard, because we do have lettuces in the front yard, the HOA don't recognize them as lettuces. So those ones are bolting. But the ones in the, yeah, the ones in the back that are darker are not yet. What is your experience, Dave?
So our backyard actually is facing north. So we get probably 6 months of shade. And that means that the temperatures back there, it warms up much slower than the front yard. So we just have to plan that accordingly. We kind of get this intense growing season during the summer where we can grow a lot of vining crops. But it also means that things that might be late to put in the front, like peas now, it's starting to be maybe a bit too late. We can get away with putting them in the back because the temperatures just won't be that warm in the back. It's this weird microclimate where it's like 5 to 10 degrees cooler in the back, and most of the perennials don't care. because they have all these reserves stored up in their root systems. But for annual crops, it's almost like an offset growing season in our backyard.
Yeah, it's amazing when you begin to really evaluate your property and to track these things, because 10 degrees doesn't seem like that much, but it can be a really big difference to crops. I noticed the same thing. That 10 degree mark can be like an excellent harvest and the plant is thriving, to it really struggles and you hardly get anything. And I love that you're using the north part and are still sharing that you're able to grow quite a bit of food in that, because a lot of people do have areas that they're very limited on their space, and they do have shady areas and areas that are in that northern facing that don't get as much sunlight and therefore don't get as much heat. But you guys are able to find ways to make it work for you. So I love that. In those more shady and the cooler areas, what are some of the crops that you found? I know we just mentioned peas, of course, but what are some of the crops that you have found do the best in those cooler and or shady areas and still give you a pretty good harvest?
Well, right now we're growing a lot of herbs back there, and rhubarb is always a big standby. Stinging nettle, which is great, a companion plant to tomatoes. We do grow tomatoes there, and we look at this is one of the things that about permaculture is just really studying your space and looking for those microclimates. So there are, even within that microclimate of a cooler space, there are little pockets where they are warmer than the others, and that's where we plug in tomatoes, rotating them still so they're not in the same space, but yeah, close to that same space, and you know, putting that stinging nettle and the marigolds, making sure that we have pollinators in there for them, oregano.
It was kind of an experimental thing where I think the first years we made some mistakes, like we tried things out. So we put in some root crops, discovered that those don't really grow well without a lot of sun. But I think the things that do well are a lot of these perennials that don't need as much light. So we've got a whole bunch of different berry crops in the back. We have gummy berries, we have gooseberries, we have elderberries, strawberries, blackberries. So we find like berries in general can grow pretty well in partial shade. You might not get quite as much harvest, but you still get enough that it's worth kind of filling out your space with those different berries. And then the in terms of fruit trees, we try to pick ones that grow in the understory. So historically, they might have grown in a forest underneath taller trees, so they're used to not getting as much sunlight. So that our big producers there, as we have pawpaw trees. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, I just planted pawpaws last week and I'm still like so excited and geeking out.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you're right. That's what I found in my research, and I had a gentleman from the nursery that they came out and totally different than your regular fruit trees in my experience, because they do need to be in that understory. So when you said pawpaw, I'm sure you heard my breath go like, oh, like I'm so excited.
It is really exciting the first time you plant the pawpaw, because it's very quick to yield, and you may need some help pollinating. So you have, how many pawpaws do you have?
I just have two, but they're both of different varieties. So they're cross-pollinating varieties.
Awesome. Yes. So we have two as well, and they yield pounds of fruit, and that's where the tropical, they say that's an interesting, I'm sure you probably already geeked out on the origins of the pawpaw, but perhaps for your audience.
No, please share. I'm very fascinated by all things pawpaw right now. It's like my pet thing. So please indulge.
Yes. Yes, there is a book called Pawpaw. It's like a red book, I think. And I'm thinking of a different book, but there is a book all about the pawpaw tree right now. And historically they say that it was that when the temperatures were still like tropical or hotter, then it was one of those tropical fruits that got stuck here, and somehow those, you know, the mastodons or whatever, they pooped it out, and it just acclimatized to this area. And here we have like a relation to the mango or the the tropical, it's like a cross between the banana, right? They say that. In the Philippines, where I come from, it really, when I had my parents taste it, they said it tasted like what we called atis, which right now I can't remember what it.
Cherimoya
or custard apple. Mm, that's what it is. And they were like, oh, this is definitely that custard apple, they said in Tagalog. And so it was just, that's just, for me, it's just thrilling to find something that, again, like it pushes the envelope, is really delicious. And the weirdest thing is
you have to, it's one of these ancient trees. So it doesn't attract your typical pollinators. It's actually pollinated by flies.
Yeah, that's what he was telling me. In fact, he said that the blossom, which actually planted it out in the, where we have some alders and maples and some cottonwoods. So it's in that understory, but not underneath the evergreens. And it's in, our cows can get there. So I'm going to protect it from that. But he was saying it's probably good that you have it a little bit further than your house, because he was saying it was the flies pollinated. And he said the blossoms don't always have a pleasant scent to them necessarily, because they are attracting the flies. Have you noticed that at all?
For our varieties, we don't notice any scent. And
okay,
there were years that we didn't pollinate them and they didn't give us as much fruit. So we've been hand pollinating them just to be sure.
Okay.
We have seen the zebra or the swallowtail butterflies that pollinate them that are unique to the pawpaw but just in case, I guess, because we're always like trying to maximize our production, like how many. Then we're like, no, we're just going to make sure this time. So we take a little brush and we just cross pollinate both trees to help the flies along. And maybe we'll see some more zebra swallowtail butterflies pollinate them.
Yeah,
they like growing by the banks of rivers.
Okay, and we have lots of flies when you have cattle, because anywhere you have poop, you have flies. So
yes, that's what I was thinking of when you said that the livestock was there. Yeah.
I don't think I'll have to, because we normally have quite a bit of flies, though I have hand pollinated, not pawpaws, obviously, I have hand pollinated some of our other fruit before I brought in mason bees, because I was noticing I have a lot more pollinator plants now than when we first moved on our property. But when I first put in our fruit trees, I wasn't getting very much harvest, even though the trees were of age and I had lots of blossoms and cross-pollinating varieties. And so I hand-pollinated for a year, and then I thought, okay, we are bringing in mason bees. I wasn't ready to do honeybees. And then I've planted a lot more pollinators now, so I don't have to, knock on wood, hand-pollinate anymore. But it's actually, it can be very laborious if you've got a lot of trees and large trees to try to hand pollinate, but it's kind of fun. I felt like a little bit like a little garden fairy with my paintbrush. I thought it was kind of fun, actually.
Oh, I think that's really inspirational what you said about, you just bring the mason bees in, and you know, and having more of those pollinator plants just changed everything for you. I think hopefully that'll, you know, get people growing more of the flowers, and myself as well. Just keep on adding flowers and keep on adding pollinator plants. So thank you for that, Melissa.
Oh, yeah. And so we've been actually talking quite a bit about, a lot about permaculture. And I know that's something that you guys really employ in order to get as much as possible out of your smaller space. And I know a lot of times people have some questions, or we are hearing the term permaculture more and more, which I think is fabulous. It's becoming something that people are talking about more, even in mainstream gardening and society, etc. But I think a lot of people may have heard the term here or there, but maybe aren't 100% sure what permaculture and organic gardening mean. Are they, you know, kind of the same thing, or the difference, or how they work together? So do you guys want to maybe expound and kind of explain a little bit how you've used permaculture in your space and what it's meant for your guys' production?
Sure. So permaculture is a design system that was born in Australia in the 70s when David Holmgren and his thesis advisor, Bill Mollison, coined the word from the concept of permanent agriculture. So that was 40 or 50 years ago. So it's changed a lot. It's kind of spread around the world, and it's starting to become more popular. But in general, permaculture is looking at the functional relationships that occur naturally in your garden or your home or your community. So as a permaculture designer, you're looking at the more of the ecology of the system, and you're instead of in a traditional kind of like monocrop environment, you're growing things and you're not really paying attention to whatever the natural environment is. But in permaculture, you're looking at that the relationships that are present in nature between the organisms in the soil, between plants that grow well together, and the different spaces that they occupy, and you're trying to maximize that so that you're kind of piggybacking off of nature, and because of that, nature is actually the most productive agricultural system. So you're putting less effort into it, and getting a lot of benefit from that. So there's a lot of things that you would observe in your yard if you wanted to do a permaculture. So these things would be like how the sun moves through your property, all the energy that moves through your property. So you're looking at how the water flows through the property, the different microclimates that exist there, the wind and things like that. But you're also looking at the plant life. So the especially looking at the soil, there's a lot of functional relationships between organisms in the soil that can really affect the health of your plants.
Yeah, and as a result, permaculture systems aim to inherently be no waste. They are cyclical, even spiral systems that get better with time, with each turn of the season. And there's a succession that makes the growth more efficient, more stable, more diverse, more abundant. And the permaculture designer's role in all of this is to shepherd and guide this system, reducing the amount of garden work. And what I love about permaculture and I love about this podcast is that you're a woman of faith, Melissa. And one thing that drew us to permaculture, Dave and I, was that its principles were universals. And for me, once a year I give around the Christian season of Lent, I give a webinar on finding God in the garden and basically just looking at the patterns, because that's how the fingerprint of God is revealed. Yeah. And it's a big part of permaculture is just to observe, is to observe the natural patterns, those cyclical patterns. And when you think about how nature's way is that sort of spiral, that beginning and beginning again, and that everything is renewed or better each turnaround, each year in your garden, it's sort of like, why do we?
So I love everything that you shared about getting to watch it and how permaculture really helps, you know, as you said, as we go through those seasons and through those life cycles, and it builds upon it. And so every year things become stronger and usually more improved and healthier, and in really observing, and instead of working against nature, is trying to work with it. And I even have shared a lot on picking varieties and plants that grow well in your climate. Don't try to pick things that you're going to have a real big struggle with. And so I love that, because you guys are really sharing the same thing. And beyond the observation, which I think is really key in understanding your land, exactly how you said, for people who are wanting to implement more of the permaculture growing into their gardens and in their yards and stuff, doing the observation first, but then what are a few other steps that you would recommend that people start with on implementing permaculture?
Sure. So in a small space, permaculture can be kind of be confusing, because there's all these large concepts in terms of you don't know exactly where to start. So what we do is we kind of feel that permaculture is this ongoing spiral of improving your garden. You're not going to get it perfect the first time around. So in that first cycle through the spiral, we kind of recommend it, keeping it simple and focusing on a single season of growing in your garden, whether that's a few containers on a deck or a raised bed or other garden area. So in that first go round of the spiral, you're just trying to focus on starting to integrate different systems in your garden. What we recommend is, let's say you've only grown a few varieties of annuals before, so we're trying to get a more diverse set of annual crops. So there's I think seven main plant families that annuals come from. So trying to diversify the things that you're growing in your raised bed so that you try to get at least one of each of those plant families in each of the raised beds. And that's from the annual side. And then in that first go around, just maybe picking a few perennial elements that will last longer than a few years that you start to put in there. So maybe you put in a berry bush, maybe you put in a fruit tree or some pollinator flowers that will improve your tomato harvest. But you don't try to go crazy initially, because that can be quite overwhelming. A lot of people will try to design their whole, you know, they might have a quarter acre backyard and they'll design everything and it'll become a little bit too overwhelming to actually implement all of that. And what's useful is if you start out small, you might have a plan for what eventually you would like it to look like, but then you can see what works and what doesn't work, and then cycle back after that first go round and tweak the things that you now learned from what you've grown in that space.
Oh, yeah, I love that. And I have to say, we've been on our property since, oh goodness, I'm going to try to do math in my head here. Since 2006. So for 14 years. And I still am, just like you said, I'm still every year coming back and looking and being like, okay, well, this was working. This didn't work. Let's change this here. Let's add this. And so I think that's such good advice, is to not try and do everything all at once. And to know that it's going to evolve and change even years out, and just to expect that as part of the process, I think is really key. Because I think a lot of times people get in their head like it needs to look this certain way, or this is what they want, and they want to do it all at once. And then if it doesn't work out, then they feel like, oh man, well, you know, I failed at this. And so I think if we go into it with that expectation that it's going to continually change and continue to evolve and become better and better each year, that you'll be a lot happier with your garden.
Yeah, one of the big things in permaculture is this idea of stacking functions. So that's where you have these functional elements in your garden that help each other. For example, you have a deep taprooted plant that dredges up lots of nutrients that plants that are growing around that plant will be able to utilize to grow larger, but it's also providing some kind of edible crop. So the thing that a lot of people who are new to permaculture, and the mistake they make is it's kind of like a puzzle. They're trying to get as many functions stacked right at the beginning. Where what we've discovered through our experience, it's more like you, as you go back, you figure out, oh, okay, now I can integrate this other system into this thing that's already existing in our garden. So for example, a couple of years back, I started getting into mushroom gardening, and there are spaces, because our backyard is north facing, there are areas like under our deck that get no sun, but are perfect for growing mushrooms. But if I had tried to integrate that in right at the beginning, it would have been overwhelming. But now I can kind of integrate these additional functional elements into our garden more naturally.
Oh, I love that. In fact, it's so funny. We just started, we have wild mushrooms that grow here that we forage, but we just got our first mushroom spores, and we just have our very first two little baby lion's mane mushrooms growing right now. It's so
cute.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. It's so cute to have and harvest and eat. And yeah, we have them for breakfast.
Oh,
especially when they start getting those teeth, what they call the teeth.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm really excited. We have found them growing wild here, but I thought, okay, well, we know that they grow in this environment. They already grow here natively. So mm-hmm. Let's see if we can bring some spores in and get more of them growing here on our property. So I'm really excited that you mentioned mushrooms, because that's a new venture for us, trying to grow them from spores and not just having them be out in the wild. So I'm excited about that.
Oh my gosh. So exciting. Yay. Excited for you too.
Are you using logs did you inoculate logs with them, or are you?
So we got to start off with, we kind of wanted to test it. And so we got it's not a log that we've drilled into and inoculated yet. That's going to be our next one. Right now, it's actually in my back bathroom where it's supposed to be the pool. We've got this little, it came like wrapped, and it's like the spores are in like this little log that, so basically the inoculation has been done for us. And so we just have to keep it moist and out of direct light and between 50 and 70 degrees with the ideal humidity. So it was just kind of a test. Like, let's see if we can do this just in the back bathroom, which is the coolest spot in the house right now. And so I'm really excited. We're on day 12 and have got, they're probably about an inch right now.
Cute. They're awesome. Pinning.
Yeah, so it's very exciting. And so then we'll kind of, this was our first like foray. And so my husband's like, well, let's just test it like this now. And then if we're like excited and it goes well, then we'll look at doing some actual inoculation on logs outside. That type of thing. So,
oh yeah, I'm sure like it'll one. Grow. Yes, I'm sure it'll grow so well for you because of your climate, and that's where, you know, the fungi movement started.
Yes,
in America.
Yes,
so wonderful.
Yeah, cool Pacific Northwest. We're usually pretty well suited to most of it. So, anyways, yeah, I'm excited. It's kind of that, and pawpaws apparently are my pet growing projects this year. So, yeah, very exciting stuff. But one other thing that you guys had mentioned that I thought would be really fun, because we employ all organic gardening here, and I've done quite a few different podcast episodes in talking about, you know, what organic actually means for a backyard gardener and then for large agriculture and farming and et cetera. But I love this. You say that you guys have something that you teach that's 10 things that most organic gardeners forget about, which naturally intrigued me. And I'm like, okay, well, you have to share, because what if I'm forgetting one of these things? So I would love for you to go through that.
Well, if you have a few minutes, I can sing you these 10 steps. Because
yes.
Well, when I first learned permaculture, we learned something called P.A. Yeoman Scales of Permanence. And P.A. Yeomans was an Australian engineer who in the 1950s, developed these scales of permanence as a tool to evaluate or assess your land. So once again, we're going back to just learning your land. So the 10 crucial steps I'm about to sing really quickly are an adaptation of the original ones. But basically, because it has, depending on who you get as your permaculture teacher, they'll change it a little bit to suit like backyard gardening. And the underlying principle is, before you work your land, you really, I mean, really have to get to know it. So especially before you do earthworks, where you move the land, and especially if there are organic gardeners out there who are doing organic gardening with a more on like the aesthetic reasons rather than the functional, I think both are important, but it's important to listen to the land. So here goes. First thing is to observe, to think holistically. Three, note your zones of use. So the first two we've kind of talked about. We always look at the bigger picture of where your garden lies, and as in this whole scope of your property. The third, zones of use, is actually the frequency in which you visit a specific area in your land. So where would it make more sense to have your kitchen garden? It would naturally make more sense to have it where you can easily reach it, close to your kitchen, which is a zone of use that would probably be called number one, which is more frequently visited, than a zone five, which is more of your foraging areas and the places that you visit least frequently. In fact, Bill Mollison, the person that Dave mentioned earlier, who coined the word with his student David Holmgren, permaculture, used to say that in the morning, when you make your omelets, put on your fuzzy slippers and get your chives from your backyard. If you come back and your fuzzy slippers are wet, then you've put them too far away. So things like that, you know, like just making sense of how often where does it make sense? So four, note your local climate. Five, know your microclimate, which we talked about a lot. Six, note topography. And the topography of the land helps you figure out where the hills are and where the water would naturally drain. In a smaller space, it would be how much water runs off your roof. should be another thing to consider, because the water, especially if you have listeners who live in the more arid climate zones of America, those places their most important thing is water, is trying to capture that water. And we often neglect that, we often forget that we can capture that water from our roofs. And that's an area that if we could just direct the downspouts, we learned this from another permaculture author, a friend of ours, Amy Strauss, directing her downspouts into the land and making little drainage ditches that would direct the water into her garden. That can make sense, right? So how much? I'll start from the start. First thing is to observe, to think holistically. 3, note your zones of use. 4, know your local climate. 5, find your microclimate. 6, note topography. How much water runs off your roof? Where do people go? So the 7th, or I don't know, 8th part is the paths, considering the paths that the traffic areas, or even where your animals often graze, or where you see the deer come in all the time. And sometimes we try to force certain paths because we want to maximize space. That was our case. We wanted to maximize our growing space. And so we just blocked pathways because we were trying to make everything a garden bed. And so we had to sacrifice some of that in order to facilitate the movement around your property. So where do people go? Investigate the weeds that you don't know. And each of the weeds that you see coming out of your backyard or your front yard or your property really tell a story. They tell a story of what the soil needs in that particular area. And if you see the roots that are very hairnet-like, those kinds of weeds are trying to bring the rocky soil, keep them from crumbling. If you see weeds that are very deep tap-rooted, they're trying to break compacted soil. So those would be like the dandelions and chickweed. They're trying to break through the compacted clay soil that we have. And some of them are herbal. So it's great to investigate your weeds. So, all right, let's go back. Where do people go? Go investigate the weeds that you don't know. And then finally, make it look pretty. Find a shape in your yard. It's fun to wander through the 10 steps with you. And I don't know the rest of my song, but that's it. Those are the 10 steps. And the reason I made them is because I could never remember what the scales of permanence were. And so I just made a song so that I could teach others to remember what it was. But the last one, which my teacher added, which was not in the original scales of permanence, was the aesthetics. And that's because, and that's kind of like the marketing of your garden. If you're trying to promote this message of, come on, let's grow things, especially in suburban urban areas. If it doesn't look good, then people won't buy it and they won't believe in your message yet until they start seeing it looks good and it tastes good. And so, yeah, so those are the 10 steps.
Oh, my God. Okay, I love it, and I love that you sang it. Like, seriously, I'm like, oh, this is so awesome. So I'm so glad that you shared that. And, gosh, there is just a wealth of information in those 10 steps. So, yeah, I would love it if you email it to me. I want to have it written down. And that was so much fun. And I'm with you. I used to be my garden's primary focus was just on food production. And then about, gosh, I think going on about 4 years now, I really started to switch that. And it still is about food production, but I really wanted it to, like you said, to look pretty and to be a place that I enjoyed being just visually, even if I wasn't harvesting, even though I do both of those together now. And so I love that you added in that it should look pretty and it has that visual aesthetic to it. So I think that was an excellent thing to add in there.
Oh, thanks. It was, yeah, it's, I always have that because I do have, being in the urban place where you have, or meeting people who are both vegetable growers, and then you have the ornamentalists, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of want to marry those two and have the best of both worlds, because you And I'm still struggling. Like, I go to Amy Strauss, the author that I mentioned, for help with making my front yard edible, because we have been cited by the HOA, edible and beautiful at the same time, because we have been cited by the HOA several times. So it's an ongoing struggle. But I think that's a key. If people want that, I think it's not something that I neglect. I say, yes, we should be, you know, we grow to homestead. But you're right. That's a different sort of yield. That's more like spiritual and peaceful and calming, that you enjoy your yard.
Yeah. And I think especially because at the time we're recording this, we're still in amongst all the COVID-19 and a lot of shelter in place orders for different states. Mine is one of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm spending more time at home. I already was a pretty much of a homebody. I work from home, and we spend a lot of time here. We're not huge travelers or on the go a lot, but I'm spending more time than ever at home and in my own yard. And so I actually just, we removed some sod and are expanding one of my herbal cottage garden areas, because I'm like, well, I mean, the lawn's okay, but really we've got this space. Let's maximize it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm putting in an entire new bed, and we're also putting in, I'm tripling my asparagus crowns. Like, we're adding quite a bit more perennials this year for both food and medicine and just beauty. So I think it's something important, because a lot of us are going to be spending even more time than we probably have normally in our yards and in our own gardens. So thank you guys so much for coming on. There was a wealth of information that you shared. I really enjoyed our time together. And one final question, you guys, and you've mentioned too, your garden mentor and permaculture mentors. So what is that you guys do to grow it yourself? And what do you consider, or what exactly do you mean by the term garden mentor?
So Grow It Yourself is our premium subscription service, where we basically provide informational resources, an online community of like-minded growers, free heirloom seeds and cuttings, and virtual coaching using regular Zoom calls to help people get their gardens more productive and sustainable. So the idea for this service came about because Nikki used to do a lot of in-person, when we discovered permaculture, which was about 6 or 7 years ago, Nikki used to do a lot of in-person consulting, and we have 6 kids. So we just felt like we weren't making as much of an impact as we'd like to with the limited time that we have, and that we'd have to drag the kids along to a lot of these things. So we were also doing a lot of online webinars and articles and generating a huge amount of content. So we wanted to organize it a bit to make it more structured and accessible. So our main intent with GIY, Grow It Yourself, is to build an online community of like-minded individuals to create that permanent community online, to tie in with the permaculture thing, that is dedicated to growing their own food. So we currently have a core course that we've created, which goes through that first spiral that we were talking about, starts with teaching people how to start their own seeds successfully, how to choose the kind of things that they would grow based off a kind of a planting calendar, and then go get through a harvest in about 3 months. Then we have, once they complete that core course, we have additional master classes that get into some of the more advanced topics like composting or integrating mushrooms into your gardening or backyard orcharding. So GIY is evolving. But we're also working on software tools to help manage the production side of gardening, because once you get up to a certain point where you're getting quite a lot of harvest, it's a little difficult to take notes and manage all of that stuff. So I'm a software developer by trade. So I'm really interested in creating digital tools to help people manage all the information and manage their gardens to help keep them organized. And we're also interested in storing and structuring all the useful information that we gather from these people who participate in GIY into something that becomes a permanent, easily searchable agricultural reference.
Or even people who aren't, like, you're a wealth, a treasure trove of information, Melissa, and all your data and information, you know, once we figure out what this database, gardening database would look like and how it would be easily searchable. You know, we would be able to pull from different communities and different growers around the States and around the world even.
Got it. Okay. I love that. Well, thank you guys so much for sharing. I feel like this time has opened so many people's eyes to the need to not just think about gardening, but to actually jump in and do it if they weren't already. And then for those who were already gardening, myself included, is looking at ways that I can increase what we're growing here in our own backyards and bring in even, you know, more food, not just to, as far as volume, but even more varieties. And so thank you guys so much for just helping other people, myself included, do that as well. So I really enjoyed our time together, and we'll have to get back together again. I had so much fun. So thank you. Yeah,
yes. And we're looking forward to your speaking to our audience as well, Melissa, on canning and preserving soon. So we look forward to speaking to you again, that we will speak again in the future.
Yeah,
no it'll doubt. Be. Thank you.
Yeah. You're talking about cycles and the spirals. And I'm like, it's the planning and the planting and getting the food in. And then for me, boom, it moves right into preserving. So which is not exactly what we were meaning when we were talking about permaculture, but I feel like it definitely follows those guidelines. So yeah. Thank you guys. Well, have a great day. And thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's pleasure. Great to chat with hardcore
fellow nerd.
it's really fun to be around people who get it, because if you're not a gardener, you're not interested in it. You can always tell, because especially in person, which we're having less of these days, but you know, people are so, for the most part, sweet and polite, but you can tell when you're talking to someone who's interested in it, because like their face lights up and you know their voice changes and you can hear the excitement. And that's really fun, because that can be a little bit few and far between. So
oh, thank you so much for all you do for us, for this podcast and for your blog and your books.
Aw, thanks, guys. Same to
You're
you.
You're welcome.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. Nikki and Dave were so much fun, shared so much good information. And if you are planning on growing more of your own food this year, or you're already growing more of your own food, and you need a guide on knowing when things are ready to harvest, how many pounds you need of certain produce in order to then preserve it up, and what are the best ways to preserve it? Is it canning? Is it dehydrating? Is it freezing? Is it fermenting? Is it maybe all of those? You want to make sure that you get your hands on my new book, or I should say my newest book. It came out in January, The Family Garden Plan. There are amazing charts in there that show you not only how much to plant for the planning part, but also take you through the harvest period. And if you're starting to see any pests and or disease, because this is usually the time that those start to make an appearance, there is incredible charts inside there, along with different recipes and items to use, all organic and natural, to help you combat disease and pests so that you get your maximum amount of harvest. So you can go to familygardenplan.com and get your copy of the book. Thank you guys so much, and I can't wait to be back here with you next week.